Anton Ehrman.
Thank you very much, Nicholas. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. It's my pleasure to lead this and moderate this panel session, which we think will be quite informative and opportune given the current sort of topics that's been discussed during the morning and this afternoon. My name is G. Kim. I'm a managing shareholder of Vedder Price here in the Singapore office. We're a full-service firm offering advisory and legal services to our clients across the globe in the United States, London, and here in Asia, based in Singapore. As previously indicated, the topic of our discussion here is chartering corporate strategy in a transforming world. For the for those who are uninitiated, in our sector, shipping may seem like a pretty straightforward business, right? Cargo gets picked up in one location, dropped off in another, charter hire is paid, and the supply chain sort of moves along. But even in that simple statement, there are certain premises and things that we generally perhaps take for granted that we shouldn't. Certainly the ports must be open. I mean, we certainly have heard the news of what's happening in the U.S. and whatnot. The ships must be able to fuel. They must be able to cross the ocean safely. The ideas of earlier in the year and last year where ships have to be rerouted through because of various issues through the Capes, adding to the time that it takes for voyages to occur, which inevitably disrupts supply chain delays. And then thinking more about the macro issue, certainly conversations have been had not only during the floor and discussions, but in general, how perhaps the PRC market has been slowing and the trading has been slowed. But has it really slowed in a global scale? Where is the potential growth and where is the trade actually being picked up? Is it here in Southeast Asia, perhaps? We hear about the U.S. market, the idea of a recession coming, maybe it is already here and we're in the beginnings of it or in the midst of it. Or if you look at the U.S. metrics and the numbers, seems to be quite robust and doing pretty well. So it is clear, however, that shipping in the global scale will continue to play an instrumental role in any and all circumstances, certainly in the current market environment. While we all want calm seas, ideal market conditions, safe global movement, there will be challenges, there will be disruptions, whether that is economic, geopolitical, or any other reason. And shipping must adapt and get the job done at the end of the day. So based on that premise, since we're at that introduction, let's see how our industry will indeed adapt and get the job done. How will the market participants and decision makers optimizing the corporate strategies and the capital allocation and the various factors that we're confronted today, whether that may be regulatory, geopolitical, environmental, and how are those decisions impacting the shipping sector? So with that introduction, I would kindly ask, perhaps Christoph, you can start us off with a brief introduction of your business, your company, and sort of updates and news that you could share with the group here before we get into the specific questions and topics.
Yeah, thanks. Borealis Maritime, we are a bit of an unusual type of shipping company. We invest institutional capital across the maritime space, and we try to find the right risk and return opportunities for the kind of capital that we invest. We have deployed quite a bit of capital in an opportunistic way over the last 10 years. We built up a significant presence in the container market, in the chemical space, and in the recent years in the offshore market. We have invested quite a bit of institutional capital on the lending side as well. So we're lending also capital into the industry where we finance other owners. And we also are, as of recent, doing a bit more structured type of investing, so more, say, leaseback type structures or deals with a bit more charter coverage around the investment, so rather opportunistically, more strategically or structured. So we move between sectors. We are not tied to one sector. We move across everything that we find interesting. And that means that we need to be very much informed about all the various sectors, and we need to be nimble around the executing opportunities in segments that we may have not been involved in sometimes before. So this is in very short terms how we
excellent. I think the key term there is sort of that looking and seeking opportunity, right? In the and not necessarily focused on not necessarily having a narrow focus, but more of a having the depth of knowledge and sort of the industry knowledge that's required to optimize sort of your platform. Yeah.
Yes, and you have to also, you have to adapt. With that, I mean that, the shipping environment changes all the time. Right now we have a market where literally everything is expensive. And so you have to adapt the way you invest capital at this stage and also what kind of capital you can invest at this stage in the cycle.
Excellent. Next to him is Johan, if you can give an introduction as well.
Yeah, thank you. Busch Group is not a shipping company. We're involved in shipping with a partner. Busch was an ailing stevedoring company in Hamburg, involved mainly in traditional or conventional cargo handling. I took over the company a bit more than 20 years ago. We're still involved in ports recently, focusing more on kind of energy ports, mainly for the offshore wind business. We started Busch Capital also to get invited to these kinds of events, basically to have a better access to the better understanding and access to capital markets. Different from other Germans, we did not shipping funds, shipping KG funds, but box funds. So we funded container box fleets. Opened up a subsidiary here in Singapore and assisted Bank T in setting up a good regime for container leasing companies. We are involved in from boxes. We went into container shipping. Wrong moment, 2007. However, we survived. In 2017, we merged with Leonhard & Bloomberg, which is one of the Hamburg-based shipping. Companies mainly involved, usually involved completely in containers. 2.5 years ago, we started divesting into tankers and most recently also in small bulkers. And then we are involved in my newest project was basically LNG building or setting up, preparing everything for Germany's first LNG land-based LNG terminal, which we just took FID, a few weeks ago. So quite spread, but connected, but very different.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Next to him, John Su, if you can tell us a little bit about Erasmus.
Thank you, Jimmy. Very good afternoon to everyone. So my name is John Su from Erasmus Ship Invest Group. Actually, been a great honor to be in Singapore here, especially in a great panel with most, German background owners and CEOs. So I'm very much honored to be here. And then, the company that Erasmus Group is set up by myself since 2010. And initially, we were involved only on dry box side, from handy size up to cape size, across all the segments on the dry. And then since before COVID time, we also entered different domains of fully pressurized gas carriers on the coaster side, and then also container feeder vessels. At the moment, we have in total all the three sectors close to 40 vessels, including some new buildings placed in order in Japan. I think from our day one of business model, we have fixed almost all our vessels to the largest commodity trading companies of the world, in dry, in oil, gas, and also on the feeder container to also major liner companies. So I think at the moment it's a pretty interesting time, as Jimon also introduced. Geopolitically, we are facing an unprecedented situation worldwide. And also on the shipping market, we have seen very expensive assets, and then quite a booming market due to some kind of a disruption of the world. So I think it's a good moment to discuss, to explore. Let's find a crystal ball together for strategy. Thank you.
Appreciate that that introduction there. Next one, we can hear a little bit about the Haren Group. Yep. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Haren Group is a Germany-based ship owner, operator, and manager. We've been in the business now for almost 35 years, and we have developed, I think, a fairly unique overall situation or position. Because we are not only a ship owner, but we operate all our ships ourselves. Mainly, or the half of the fleet is operated in the heavy lift and break bulk markets. Probably known brands are SAL and Intermarine, which belong to our group. We have also business in the dry bulk side, which we also operate ourselves, and the tanker space. And the interesting part, I think, is that all of these dry bulk, dry segments kind of going from one segment to another, from heavy lift, from less heavy to bulk. So we actually cover the whole range of dry cargoes in our own services globally. We are set up with 25 offices in 23 countries. And we actually do connect all those dots into our third business line, which is the ship management side, where we operate or manage the ships with the view from an owner, because we own ourselves, so we know what it means to be an owner. We manage the ships with a charterer's mindset, because we are charterers ourselves, including the bunker bill, which is on our side. So it's kind of a fairly holistic approach to the business. It's good to be here, good to discuss what's next.
Yep, thank you. And last but not least, but Piyush, if you can tell us about the...
Thank you, Jibun. Yep. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Piyush Sharma. I'm Group Director, Corporate Strategy with the NSB Group. We are both a usual and an unusual shipping group. On the usual side, we are a maritime services group. Main businesses being ship management, new building, crew management, maritime training. On the unusual side, we are also an incubator of startups. We invest in external startups, our own startups. We have been in existence since 1982. In the glory days, we also had the unique distinction of being one of the first few German tanker managers on the gas side in the 90s. At the peak of the market, we were one of the largest container managers across the globe in terms of container tonnage. And right now, we are proud to be one of the most innovative SMEs in Germany, having won an award 3 times in the last 4 years for our innovation capabilities. We are headquartered in Buxtehude, which is south of Hamburg. We have a branch office here in Singapore, and we have satellite offices across Philippines, China, South Korea, and Sri Lanka. And thank you for having us on the panel, Jibun. Good to be here.
And I appreciate the panelists here for that brief introduction, and that certainly lends itself to the unique perspective, hopefully, that the audience will be able to garner here. Generally, I like to start the discussion with... from a bigger picture item perspective, with queries on corporate strategy, and then we can kind of tailor it down to specific elements of what that actually means. But in general, the first question I would pose to the members here are, how are the shipping companies in the global maritime sector dealing with and adapting to the current market challenges that are posed by the various market volatility that you see, whether that's due to the economic reasons, the geopolitical reasons, perhaps it's the increased focus on ESG or the increasing regulations that we tend to see on a global scale. So, Christoph, if you could start us off with sort of your thoughts on a big picture matter.
Yeah, thank you. So it's interesting. It's almost 4 o'clock, and I think so far at this conference, we have talked about alternative fuels, retrofits, startups, safety. This was the first dry cargo panel of 40 minutes I've ever gone through where the word demand and supply never occurred. It's extraordinary, So of course this is important. All these topics, I don't want to, dismiss that these topics are important, but at the same time, first and foremost, most of us here are trying to make money in this industry, and money is still made by getting demand and supply correct and obviously embracing new technologies, but it's not all about just that. So, for us, it's the way we invest capital, as I said, it's institutional capital. It has different risk and return profiles for each investor. Some investors are, you know, having, you know, based on the capital that they again have from pension funds, and others have sometimes higher ESG requirements. Some have lower ESG requirements, or for some of our investors, we are a small side pocket where they can kind of play the market without having the fear that they're constantly being monitored about their ESG profile. But it's one of the things that we have certainly noted ourselves, given that our capital is institutional capital. If I go to New York these days, I may have 50 names in my book from private equity firms that in the past we have visited, have spoken to, who have shown an interest in maritime. And 5 years ago, I probably could have gotten meetings with 40 of them. Today, maybe 10 are willing to receive me. And that is mostly down to many of them have ESG agendas today that does not give them the authority anymore to invest into a polluting industry, as I see it. They forget the services sometimes that this industry does to the world, and with that I mean particularly also to the developing world and what the maritime industry has achieved in regards to lifting countries out of poverty into a connected world. The ESG agenda seems to be trumping everything for some of them, and they no longer can embrace transportation as a sector they can invest into. And then others are obviously questioning, you know, why shipping now? Most of these have been more opportunistic and distressed-oriented investors who have in the past obviously very much focused on shipping. But they have other sectors that they can invest into right now, and they feel that shipping is maybe not an opportunistic market right now, which we very much agree on. So for us, it's really find the right risk and return projects right now, which is not easy. It's one of the most difficult market environments we have seen, I would say, in regards to picking the right sector, picking the right project, and investing in this market right now is actually quite a challenge. But there are good projects around, and one has to be very selective and very cautious and also not just jump too quickly. Residual values are high, right? Or basically, values are high, and quite often residual values are high that you have to sometimes take on. So you have to be cautious around investing capital at this stage right now, and you have to be patient. You have to tell your investors also that patience pays in this case here right now, rather than rushing into projects that eventually turn out in a few years' time to be difficult. The geopolitical world obviously is always throwing a bit of a curveball to us. The last few years, you have to be careful at some dinner parties if you tell people that COVID was good for shipping, Ukraine war was good for shipping, and now the Houthi rebels are good for shipping. But this is the truth to some extent for us. The Houthi situation in the Red Sea has created what I would describe in the container market as a bit of an Indian summer. You know, before it gets really cold, we all enjoy a bit of sunshine unexpectedly. But also other market segments have obviously very much benefited in regards to, from the owner's perspective, the freight rates that they're achieving right now. But this will change again, and once this situation in the Red Sea is over, I think the container market is really going to be in for some difficult times, and also some other market segments will suddenly see much more volatility coming back. But volatility is great. You know, as an investor, you want volatility, because a stable market is actually not giving you enough investment opportunities. So we're looking forward to some geopolitical events that may actually be negative for shipping, because that gives us opportunity to invest capital at that time.
Appreciate that. Johan, your thoughts?
Christoph, you basically said everything. So, maybe a few. Basically, ESG and these things, they add an additional layer of complexity. But the general game is the classic game, where it relies to the classic, where you need the classic virtues to survive in the end, to study your markets carefully, order books, but also, as you said in the beginning, supply and demand side, look at your team, And then look where you find the money. Also, capital markets are constantly changing. When we started, there was plenty of money from Germany. It's over now, at least not in the traditional form. Now we go to Norway or to the U.S. So constantly changing, but basically same game as usual. And so we see opportunities, as I pointed out earlier. We don't see opportunities at the moment so many, so much in containers. However, that might change within a year time, but also in other markets. That's how we deal with it, with the developments.
Mm-hmm. John, let's with that premise, without sort of getting bogged down with the macro element here, let's dig down a little bit deeper. In an attempt to maximize value, what do the decision makers, what do they have to determine on how to allocate resources given the current market challenges, both in the context of capital and people, to the various businesses or the business units that you have within the company?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think basically, in my eyes, is each company has its own pocket, own strategy as well. Depends on the segments that they are in, sometimes different cycles, and also volatilities and risk can be totally different as well. If we take, for example, the large vessels and the smaller ships segments, I think the large ones certainly in any big ship segment of the main dry container and tanker market, the large vessel-sized vessels always have bigger fluctuations than the smaller ones. So I think some owners would choose probably the big ones, big assets, and then also relatively on the management side, probably the bigger the ships is, and then relatively easier to manage for a one voyage of 3 months round trip, Brazil, China, for example. Smaller vessels may be calling even more ports, and then sometimes management even more sophisticated, I think. So it really depends on as to the sources allocation. In my case, I would say to share that for me, instead of buying a VLCC for $200 million per ship, I would rather to spend for 10 smaller vessels rather than one big one. Similar things for maybe a mega container ship. Would rather buy 10 small feeders rather than, for the earning and the risk balance as well. So this is, but on the other hand, as Christoph and John already mentioned, on the big picture side, I think what I would like to add a little bit is that no matter what segment the market is as we are today, we are seeing a very much unique situation. It's pretty similar to 2007, 2008, before Lehman falls, actually, not really before COVID, is that all the shipyards now are pretty full up to the next 3-4 years. So it means that it's very difficult to say what kind of sector you would enter to add on actual tonnage now. So in the last couple of years, we sold about 10 ships on the dry bulk side. But on the other hand, unfortunately, what we sold was always on the cheap side. So we thought that we are well already performed. But on the other hand, we look back, and then there's no any new building order we can add on now. So this is something that is very, very particular at the moment, I would like to add. Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate that. Nils, from your perspective, how has the market adapted to the market challenges? And then in light of that, sort of the factors that go into the decisions on what to focus on when you're allocating or deciding where to allocate those the capital and the resources and whatnot. Yep.
But I think we have overall a slightly different approach, although we do opportunistic deals. So if there's volatility, we try to use that volatility also for some good asset investments. But the core of our activities is kind of in direct, close, and deep engagement with our end customers. And as we do all the commercial operations ourselves, we on a daily basis talk to the end users of our heavy lift vessels. We talk to the cargo owners. We talk to the owners on the break bulk side, etc. So we get this immediate in-depth feedback, not from a occasional research project, but from daily contacts with them. And that guides us. So everything we do in terms of investment, we do in order to build a ship or have a ship or buy a ship that is actually there for a purpose. So we are very much transportation purpose driven in everything we do. And that's not just only the assets, but that's all the services we do is always for having a best possible service for the end user of the ship. And that includes, by the way, everything also in terms of adding digital services and cooperating with startups, etc. But the core here really is to know your client in depth. And what really pays off here in our structure with the different vessel types is that we do not only have this deep insight into what the client actually wants to do with the ship or what the expectation on a transportation service is, but also we can connect those dots from different segments. For example, the vetting know-how and the direct feedback from oil majors on the tankers helps a lot to deal with the right ship and prepare bulkers for such inspections, or to deal with an auditor on a heavy lift operation in port who might even have an oil major background when auditing our operations and how the crew behaves. So there's a big kind of exercise in connecting the dots. But in the end, is always for the cargo operations. Everything we do is for the end client. And I think that aligns all our kind of fairly diverse activities into one kind of singularity in the end, what why and what we do it for. Mm-hmm.
Piyush, very similar question there, but I think you talked about when you were doing your introduction sort of a unique position that you have in the market. Perhaps if you could share your thoughts on not only, again, the market challenges, but, you know, sort of the factors that goes into your decisions, the company's decisions, and how to allocate capital amongst the businesses, certainly to, again, going to Christoph's point, to earn the highest rate of return if possible, given the conditions. Yeah.
Thank you, Jivan. I guess, fundamental view, which I would echo, I guess, is common to all, is, you know, fundamentally, you're always short of time, resource, and money for any investment. Same is the case with us in many companies. But ultimately, we do evaluate from time to time what are the allocations we have to do. We have built up a team to evaluate all the opportunities that we see in the market. And the three, you know, fundamental businesses which we look at is invest in people, invest in technology, and then invest in assets. So we come from a maritime services background rather than asset ownership background. So for us, the key driver is people, because they drive all the businesses. We have done ties up with universities. We have created leadership programs internally. And on investing in technology, as I mentioned previously, we are heavy into looking at what digitalization can offer. Obviously, we are a boutique manager, so we look at how the economies of scale can be achieved through digitalization rather than the numbers game. And then, of course, given the background that we are in the industry for so many years, we are also looking at co-investments in vessel projects. So that is how we allocate our time and resources to be able to get the best returns for the group. Mm.
Yeah. Indeed, indeed. Circling back here, Johan, if you could, one of the things that I would be curious about hearing your thoughts on is, given the topic, how you would go about analyzing sort of the external opportunities that are outside of the company, and seeing what the market is doing, and allocating capital between the opportunities that you see on an internal basis within the company, whether that's allocating it to the investing in the people, in the existing platforms that you already have, and you're seeing outside opportunities that's happening in the market, whether there's an opportunity there in the market. How do you analyze where to go? You know, where to invest? With external versus internal?
I think it's a constantly changing environment, so it always depends on first how much money you have to spend. If there is a bit money to spend, then it's easier also to look for external things. If it's less, then at least I normally try to keep it in the company. Recently, when we did when we went into that LNG venture in the end, because we saw market, there was not a real market for gas in Northern Europe, in particular Germany. They all reliant on pipeline gas. So we said there must be a business case, and we're proven right, fortunately. So So we invested some money there, but as I said earlier, normally we look to external opportunities, of course, and I said opportunities, so it's a bit opportunistic, and we look mainly also to how deep our pockets are,
yeah,
and then make our decision.
Yeah. Christoph, any final thoughts on this line of query?
Yeah, we're slightly different than more or less everyone here on the panel. Maybe John, not so much, but we are really the asset is our core focus, the investment into the asset and the deployment of that asset, and we are not really focused on either the service side of the business, although we have some service businesses as well. But generally, that's not the forefront of our day to day activities. And we are also not able, with the way we invest, to really be kind of investing into research and technology and test things out. We don't do new buildings. The capital that we have generally doesn't work for new buildings. And also for us, it's rather difficult to embrace new technologies by trying them out. You know, we don't know which sector we are in exactly in 5 to 10 years' time. And so for us, it's really the focus on the asset. And so for us, the internal versus external capital allocation is not really applicable for our business model.
Indeed. I think the audience has gotten to see a variety of perspective here, and I think that's very appropriate for the topic. I want to move away from the allocation of resources and talk about the corporate strategy. And the management part of it. Decision makers certainly take views on the way their business units complement each other, their correlation, and decide in which sectors and businesses that they will or perhaps more appropriately won't go into. So what goes into deciding what businesses in the sector to be in or to be out of? So let's start with, Johan, if you could start us off with that query. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy to do so. Basically, as I said, the classical virtues. So, of course, the beginning, proper studies of the markets and proper try to get a proper understanding. What is also important in our organization is very much a kind of a swarm intelligence, as I used to call it. So really involve more people, involve the whole team and listen to everybody before you make decisions. I think that's, of course, classic risk and return, and also in the end, gut feeling very much. You listen, you're reading, you have your own views on the market, and in the end, that's also important.
Let's go to the end there then. Piyush, your thoughts. You mentioned earlier in one of your earlier answers sort of a different mindset as to how you allocate resources, your people first. When it comes to the corporate strategy, you know, how does that dovetail into sort of the businesses that you and the company would be looking into or perhaps not looking into?
Thank you. I mean, frankly speaking, we are a boutique manager, so our focus is definitely not on economies of scale. We focus on trying to, do joint ventures or partnerships to increase our service portfolio. And obviously the big point, which I mentioned before and you have corroborated, is investing in people. So what we have tended to do is, because there are so many changing situations and, the situation and the climate changes, our management team, in fact, has driven all the way to Silicon Valley to understand how the people work there, which are non-shipping. And we have even invited the Silicon Valley thinkers to our organization to educate all of us and to sort of awaken us and say, guys, if you continue with the usual within-the-box thinking, then you don't move forward. So that's a big difference we have at least incorporated in the mindset of our management, which then boils down to everybody around to say, can we think differently and see how we can do things better in terms of what is available today? So that's basically what we are aiming for.
Yep. John, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I'm quite impressed by news just now. Building up 25 offices around 22 countries, you said? 23 countries, yeah, sorry. I think that's probably the things that also we are trying to build up at the moment. I think We are entering a new era of deglobalization. Let's say put away of the challenge of global geopolitical challenges. We put the other way. I think instead, because the globalization is really facing challenges, we also trying to put a little bit different cover geographically. So in the last couple of years, we have set up a few other offices in Vietnam, in Denmark, also in Japan. So we are going to try to do the same track. And externally, we're also thinking about to see if any M&A opportunities we could also do. Certainly on the asset side, as I mentioned earlier, it's very difficult to make any decision now because the new build yards are pretty full and we are relatively on the high side. So we always remember the Greek philosophy is that to buy low, sell high, although it's not that easy to execute. Right. Thank you.
Indeed. If it was easy, everyone would be doing it, right? So, Nils, your thoughts on this topic, yeah, on the corporate strategy element. Yeah.
As I mentioned, I mean, we're very much driven by our clients. But I think it's fair to say that we are a pretty forward-leaning or proactive company, and then that's the approach we take based on this client feedback. But when I say that, what do I mean? I mean, we use all this kind of knowledge to try to shape the business we are in and not so much just passively accept what we get offered. For example, currently we are building 5 heavy lift new builds or new vessels in China, and they're going to be really nice ships. We designed them in-house with our own engineering and design teams, etc. And this is something where we try to, in our niche, to really be an impactful player and shape that niche as much as we can for the good of our customers' happiness. And I think this very much drives all we do. So where can we actually play a role, and where can we clearly answer the question, why do we exist? Why are we there? Is there a reason for us to be in the business? And I would say, yes, there is. And this drives us, and this drives our decision-making to make sure that we actually do deliver value in the end to our clients. And I think this same approach that I just described for the new buildings applies to all the other services that we offer, where we try to be not just kind of copy what everyone else did, but simply just try to be as good as we can and do that in a very collaborative way. And just one example, two examples here. We actually do love corporations, and on the commercial side of the heavy lift and break bulk business, we, for example, joined forces with another competitor, Jumbo, and we joined forces in order just to be more present in the market, but not in the sense of market share, but just simply to be able to offer more departures for our clients on different types of vessels in different ports and at different points in times. And we are engaged in quite a number of joint ventures and not always legal joint ventures, sometimes just kind of joint activities. And it's probably also fair to say that it's, I can't reveal much, but there's going to be more in this space to come because we really think this is adding value. So you don't have to do everything yourself. As long as you can add value together, then that's something we look into and that drives us as well.
Indeed. In the last couple of minutes here, what I would like to do is circle back to what Christophe initially started about, sort of the balancing the trade-off between risk and return here. I mean, at the end of the day, companies like to make money, you know, and find opportunities. But rather than going going in depth with each of these answers, if there's one or two word that you could leave the audience with as what the decision makers should be focusing on when they are managing and thinking about managing risk and the return. Christophe, if you want to start us off. Yeah.
I guess one or two words is difficult.
Yeah.
But, okay, I mean, at the end, as I said earlier, look, it's a very, very difficult, I find it an extremely challenging investment environment. You know, my business partner Elias and I, we may have ideas of what we want to do and what we find interesting. We still have to convince the capital providers to do so. Back in 2021, we had two main investment strategies. We wanted to launch a tanker fund, we wanted to launch an offshore oil and gas fund, and we got traction on the oil and gas side. We didn't get traction on the tanker side. Couldn't convince anyone to back us on tankers. In hindsight, obviously, you know, we missed a great opportunity there. So But as I said, it's weighing up the opportunities that are out there, convincing your investor that you know what you do, and that you have a realistic view on risk and return. What's achievable right now? Right now, 20% plus IRRs in shipping is tough. It's not there. And so we rather actually right now invest a bit more conservatively. You know, don't take too much residual value risk. You know, this market, we know shipping, it always changes. You know, things come from somewhere. We had geopolitical events in our favor, as I mentioned earlier. They will not always be in our favor. Don't lever up too much. Be conservative. Have a rainy fund on the side for the day when you need it. And then also be patient. You know, we all had to be patient for the upturn. And also we have to be patient sometimes for waiting for the downturn where we can deploy much more capital, much quicker. This is how the landscape really shaped up for us.
Yeah. I mean, this is certainly a topic that I think we could go on for another half hour, but I think we're at our end of our time for our session today. Certainly appreciate the insightful details and information that the members here have shared with the audience, and hopefully the audience gotten something out of it today. Thank you all.
Thank you.